While she's doing that, I'll go ahead and get started. So good afternoon, and thank you everyone for joining us for today's presentation by Jovana Davidovich, who will speak to us today on political neutrality in the military. I am Megan Phillips, your ICFRC co-director and host for today's program. As always, we thank our members, supporters, and interns for making these forums possible. I would also like to acknowledge our university and community supporters, the University of Iowa International Programs, the University of Iowa Honors Program, University of Iowa Public Policy Center, and the Stanley UI Foundation Support Organization for their financial support. I also thank City Channel 4 and the UI Digital Libraries for helping us continue to make our programs available to online audiences. Today, we have another exciting online program. Following our speaker's presentation at about 1 p.m., we will have a 15-minute Q&A. Please submit your questions via the chat function. For those of you watching on Facebook, you can submit your questions via comment and we will do our best to monitor those as well. As a final reminder, I ask that you please keep your audio and video turned off for the duration of the presentation and do not interrupt the speaker. With that, I am pleased to introduce Jovana Davidovich. Professor Davidovich is an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa, where she also holds a complimentary appointment at the Law School and the Center for Human Rights. Her research focuses on military ethics, political philosophy, international law, and organizational ethics. Jovana's publications have covered a wide range of issues, including humanitarian military interventions, displacement in war, ethics of collateral damage, and international humanitarian and human rights law. Most recently, she has developed an interest in issues around AI ethics, especially in military settings, and issues of the use of algorithms for decision-making in the military. Commonly, the military stays out of politics, and for good reason. Federal law regulates political activity for active duty military rather strictly because the consequences of having a military that is partisan can be devastating, as history has shown us repeatedly. But what exactly does it mean to say that the military ought to stay out of politics? The recent uptick in active duty military personnel commenting on government policy has reignited interest in the military's political neutrality rules. Today, Jovana will share her experience about this topic with us. Please join me in welcoming Jovana Davidovich.
Thank you, Megan. So as Megan pointed out, I'm going to share my screen. I'm going to be talking about military and political neutrality. This has been a really important and central topic in today's day and age, for obvious reasons. Military has in the past stayed out of political issues because the consequences of not staying out of political issues can be dire, as we have seen throughout history. And yet, what exactly the military ought to do in their attempts to stay out of political issues is not clear at all. So the political neutrality rules that govern the military's behavior, and in particular the behavior of active duty military members, are set out in the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the DoD Directive 1344.10. And these are, straight up rules. They tell you what sorts of things you may and what sorts of things you may not do regarding political engagement. So for example, the DoD defines political or partisan activity, and you will quickly notice that the DoD, continually the Department of Defense, continually sort of identifies political issues with partisan issues. But they define political or partisan activity as, and this is a quote, activity supporting or relating to candidates representing or issues identified with national or state political parties, right? And this idea that something is a partisan issue or political issue and therefore out of bounds for commenting, that depends on whether or not an issue is identified with a party, as you can probably already imagine, is quite problematic in the ability of these rules to govern the behavior of our active duty military personnel. It is not only the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the DoD that define political neutrality rule. Each of the branches of the military also has similarly phrased rules. So the Air Force Instruction 51902 says, for example, that members on active duty cannot, among other things, participate in any radio, television, or other program or group discussion as an advocate of, and again, key phrase, partisan political party or candidate. So let me go into a little bit more detail and a little bit more sort of general about these political rules. So looking at the DoD directive, regarding political activities of active duty military personnel. They are, for example, not allowed to participate in partisan political fundraising activities, rallies, conventions, management of campaigns, debates. And in fact, it doesn't even matter whether the person, the active duty military member, shows up in their uniform or not. It doesn't even matter if an inference of official endorsement can be drawn from their attendance at this partisan political function. Active duty military personnel is prohibited from participating in political fundraising activities, rallies, and conventions. Secondly, active duty military personnel may not use their official authority or influence to interfere in election or elicit votes, and so on. They may not publish partisan political articles or letters that solicit votes for or above a partisan political candidate or a party. They may not, again, participate in any radio and television program or discuss an issue as an advocate of a partisan political issue. They may also not speak before a partisan political gathering. So these sort of general rules go on and on and on, and I'm not going to go through all of them. The key features that the rules governing political participation of active duty military personnel have are, one, as I have been repeating, an active duty military personnel cannot publicly promote a partisan or political issue in their capacity as a member of armed forces. Secondly, they cannot disparage the office of the president, vice president, or the Congress. This is Article 88 of Uniform Code of Military Justice. So these are sort of the central features. I wouldn't even say the central rules. They're central features of all the rules that govern political participation of military members. Now, I don't want to spend too much time on the history of this, but it is sort of important to know that the commitment or the understanding of political neutrality we have today is not always been a part of our history. So very early on in American history, not only was political neutrality seen as valuable, but in fact, early presidents like George Washington screened officers for loyalty before even granting them commissions. In the time between the Revolution and throughout the Civil War and by the World War II, slowly as the military became professional, the professionalization of the military forces started sort of contributing to internalizing and valuing of political neutrality. So more and more military officers especially saw it as really important that they not speak on political issues, they don't take stands on political issues. And there's numerous cases of military generals, for example, army generals at West Point, for example, sort of promoting political neutrality among the cadets. And then around World War II, in fact, the sort of pitch of commitment to political neutrality became so significant that many military officers didn't even vote. And they thought that political neutrality actually required that if you were in the military, you shouldn't even take a stand on, even in, you know, at your privacy of a voting booth, you should not take a stand on political issues. Now, after the Second World War, after the draft ended in the Vietnam era, and with the Absentee Voting Act of 1973, which really made it possible for much of our military forces to vote, what happened was a slow repoliticization, at least relative to Second World War, of our military officer corps in particular. And that has continued until today. There's been sort of amplitudes, and so there's been ups and downs over the last 30 or 40 years in how military sees political neutrality and to what extent do they see it as central to their function. One of the interesting things that's relevant for us in understanding how we ought to think of political neutrality of military is that over the last 10 or 15 years, there's also been a significant sort of widening gap in political views within the military, but more importantly, the gap has significantly widened regarding political views of the average civilian and the average military member. So one might ask ourselves, in spite of the fact that over the years, political neutrality was seen as less or more important, it is certainly strictly governed, as we saw earlier, by the DoD directive, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and it is really internalized by our military officers. And so why? Why do we want, you know, why do we care about our military being politically neutral? Well, there's a range of aims that are very widely accepted as the reasons because of which a military ought to stay politically neutral. Military ought to not take a side in political and policy issues or on partisan matters. The four aims listed here are the ones commonly cited and pretty widely agreed upon as the central aims that underpin or justify why we should even have political neutrality rules. So one is build public trust, right? I mean, this is pretty important, right? If our military consistently sided with one political party, the civilians as well as the government, our civilian government, would have a hard time trusting that military. And we can obviously imagine how important it is that the civilians trust the military. Civilians trusting the military is absolutely necessary for us as the citizenry through our elected officials to exert effective oversight. Secondly, it is really important that the military stay politically neutral for the implementation of security policy, specifically through effective and trusted advising. So simply put, if our military was extremely partisan or extremely political, then our leadership, our civilian leadership in particular, would have very little reason to trust them when they advise them. So the military ought to stay out of political issues in the public's eye, but nobody suggests that our joint chiefs or that our 3-4-star generals ought to not advise the Congress or the Senate or the president or the vice president, right? Not only should they, you know, can they advise them, but they should. So military personnel, especially sort of upper ranks of military, contribute significantly to our security policy through advising our civilian leadership. Imagine again, if military was highly politicized or if those individuals were highly politicized and took issues on partisan topics. That would obviously undermine their ability to be trusted advisors by our civilian leaders. Thirdly, political neutrality is seen as necessary for effective authority of uniformed leadership. That simply means that if our O3s, O4s, you know, our sort of officers are able to provide leadership to our troops, those officers cannot appear to be partisan. You can imagine that, let's say you have a group of 100 soldiers, you are a leader, you are an officer, and you, for example, you consistently, let's say, criticize President Trump, or you consistently criticize, you know, the right to choice, and you have very outspoken views, let's say, about abortion. You can imagine that it would be very hard for such a leader to have effective authority over a group of soldiers that are, and rightly so, widely divergent in their political views. So it is really important for our officers to stay politically neutral so they can provide effective authority to their subordinates. Finally, it's really important for the purpose, and this is maybe one of the most important issues, political neutrality is really important for troop cohesion and morale, right? Our troops have, you know, they're very much like us. They have a range of views, and they have a range of views that they hold really deeply. And inasmuch as within the military, politics become an issue, this would undermine their ability to work together, to trust one another, and to really feel like they're fighting for the same aim. When they go out into the battlefield, they need to know that they can trust one another, but they also need to know that they are, in some sense, doing the right thing. They need to know that, in some sense, they're all there for the same aim, and that aim is not partisan, right? So these are the four aims that have commonly been put forth as reasons for political neutrality of our military. Now, in theory, right, the rules I started from, remember those two, you know, those rules, like you can't speak in political meetings, you can't write letters, you can't disparage president or office of president or vice president of Congress. And in general, you can't participate in radio or television shows and take any partisan positions, right? All those rules that govern behavior of our active duty military personnel, and primarily our officer corps, are meant to sort of meet these aims. They're meant to provide for these aims. Simply put, the idea is if we were to follow these rules, if our military officers were to follow the rules, then we should be able to achieve the aims of public trust, implementation of security policy, effective authority of uniform leadership, and troop cohesion and morale, right? To give you an analogy, you know, we have a rule. We have a legal rule, domestically speaking, that one stops at a stop sign, right? And the aim of that rule is that we have less or fewer accidents. We can coordinate our driving and kill each other less on the roads. If for some reason it turned out that the rule stop at a stop sign actually contributed to accidents and people dying, we'd abandon that rule, right? And so the idea is that we have these rules laid out in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and more importantly, the DoD Directive 134410, as well as individual branches. We have all those rules, and then we have the aims that just laid out. And the idea is, if I, as the military officer, follow the rules, and I don't speak out on political issue, I will serve these aims well. I will build trusting civil and military relationships. I will improve troop cohesion and morale. I will be able to provide effective authority to the troops, and I will retain my trusted advisory role for national security policy. Okay. So before we look at why I think this is a flawed model, I wanted to say that in addition to the rules being able to provide for the aims, in addition to the claim that if I follow the rules, these are behavior guiding rules, if I follow the rules, I'll be able to achieve these aims. These rules are also meant to help us identify when somebody is actually violating political neutrality or not, right? After all, how could these rules possibly be reason given for a military officer if he or she don't know what exactly is permitted and what exactly is prohibited? So let me give you a range of examples. These are a bit outdated, but nonetheless, so General Joseph Otell disagreeing with President Trump on pulling troops out of Syria. This is from last year. He was very public about it. Lieutenant General Jeffrey Buchanan, this is several years back, was very public and disagreed with the president on whether more help is needed in Puerto Rico. Remember, this was right after the hurricanes. Over the last few years and decades, active duty officers very often publicly supported or criticized having transgender individuals in the military, or in the past, lesbian and gay service members. Following the racist actions in Charlottesville several years back, all of the four-star generals of each of the branch had tweets posting very vocal criticism of racism. Publicly criticizing, so there wasn't a lot of public criticism of president's suggestions that our troops should target families of terrorists and engage in interrogational torture, but there were rumblings. And if there had been such rumblings, if they were more loud, how exactly would we know if that's a violation of political neutrality rules? Imagine cases of using social media to ridicule or criticize the wall. Imagine taking either using social media or going on the networks, television networks, and making a statement on the Black Lives Matters protests and Trump's tactics and the federal government's tactics in Portland and Kenosha most recently. So, you know, one of the things we have to make sure is that those rules that we started from, the so-called political neutrality rules, actually achieve those aims, that following those rules, not saying stuff on partisan matters, actually furthers the aims of troop cohesion and morale and trusted leadership and advising and so on. But we can't really, that can't happen unless we can use those rules to identify which ones of these A, B, C, D, E, and F, there's two D's, apologies for that, are actually violations of political neutrality rules. So let me give you a few examples of the way political neutrality sort of plays out in real life. Right before the 2016 election, Ted Cruz was running for president, and he suggested that we should carpet bomb ISIS and the families of ISIS fighters. And Lieutenant General Charles Brown, at the time commander of US Air Forces in the Middle East, his response to this was, carpet bombing is not effective for the operation we're actually executing because we're using precision guided munitions on a regular basis. Brown then further told reporters at the time, and on top of that, as you look at that, the law of armed conflict and us trying to minimize civilian casualties, carpet bombing is just, in my opinion, not the way to go. This is a very weak statement on whether or not we should basically throw bombs on civilians. Similarly, around the same time, and since Trump took office as the president, he has advocated continually the return of waterboarding and has considered executive memos, continuing to use waterboarding as a form of enhanced interrogation techniques, if you remember that language. And he has also insisted that the military would never refuse his order to do so. In response to these claims, I have two quotes here from two different military. So one is a General Mark Welch, and the other one is U.S. Air Force General Philip Breedlove. So he asked if waterboarding should be legalized. General Mark Welch, the chief of staff of the Air Force, carefully sidestepped the issue. The military, he said, doesn't use such techniques, and changing that is a broader policy decision. That's a classical example of sort of taking those political neutrality rules very, very seriously and sort of not speaking on what seems to be a policy decision. U.S. Air Force General Philip Breedlove, the NATO Supreme Allied Commander, was asked if U.S. allies were troubled by such torture discussions. He too said, rather than address any single element and to stay clearly out of political sense, I would just say that I get a lot of questions about this. I think they see a very different sort of public discussion than in the past. So basically, these are all examples of various, mostly generals and lieutenant generals, really high level military officers, sort of seeing themselves as staying politically neutral by basically staying out of any partisan issue. And in this case, as the partisan issues during the election, in the lead up to the election, being whether we should carpet bomb ISIS, whether we should waterboard. So it seems like now that we understand sort of what the rules of political neutrality are and what aims they're meant to serve, that they rely really heavily on the notion of something being political and something being partisan, right? So if I go back and I try to identify among these seven topics, which ones are sort of violations of political neutrality, I would have to ask myself, well, are these partisan issues? Are they political issues, right? And in my mind, at least, the terms political and partisan really don't help. Let me sort of take you back to the language early on when I listed specific rules that the military uses, right? We keep on saying you should not speak before a partisan or a political gathering. Keep on saying, I think I can hear someone. We keep on saying things like, you know, something being partisan is a particular reason why we should not take a position on that, right? But something being political cannot be a demarcating tool, right? So if I take all the statements that all the military membership or military officers make, if I try to use the tool of, is it political, it would not be a helpful tool. They, you know, military personnel is allowed to vote, for example, that's a political act, right? And so, just saying something is political can't possibly be a good way to identify what's sort of allowed and what's not allowed. But the same is with something being called partisan. And that's really the biggest problem. What's happening is we live in a very significantly changing political landscape. What is partisan today was not partisan 10 years ago. What we talk about in the public sort of discourse and what parties are taking positions on were things they wouldn't have taken positions on 10 years ago. So something being partisan simply means something that a party takes up and people feel very passionately about. And while on one hand, that's really helpful, that's exactly what we want our military to stay out of, the stuff that's really sort of controversial and makes people's blood boil and the sorts of things that would undermine our trust in them and their subordinates' trust in them and so on. On the other hand, how could we possibly use the concept of partisanship as a demarcating tool, as a tool of identifying, if I'm a military officer and I'm trying to figure out, may I or may I not comment on carpet bombing, comment on waterboarding, the language of partisanship is really difficult as a demarcating tool for me to help myself and figure out whether or not I should comment on a particular matter or stay out of it, okay? So what it seems like then is that we have rules, right? We have rules that have vague language, rules that heavily depend on the language of political issue and partisan issue, and both of those constantly shift because of the changing political landscape. So it's very vague language, and it's very hard to follow rules that are constantly shifting, right? And we might also have some missing rules, right? There might be some things we could be doing to better serve these aims, the building of trusting civil military relationships, troop cohesion, effective authority, troop morale, and so on. So in fact, in my view, because of the changing political landscape, the rules that we have today actually don't serve these aims as well as they could. So I think we should consider an alternative. And that's sort of what I primarily want to argue for today, and what I have argued actually in front of quite a few military officers in the past, and that is that we need to sort of reboot the code of political neutrality. We need to restate it. It cannot depend on notion of partisanships only. And these are the three desiderata that I have in mind for how we should approach writing these new rules. Rules that are better at two things: better at actually being able to guide behavior because they're clearer, and rules that actually aim better or help those aims that we just looked at better, these aims right here. So the blueprint for building a useful code of political neutrality that does not rest solely, it's going to still have to rest on the notions of partisanship, but not solely on the concept of partisanships, is A, we need rules that are stated clearly and precisely so they can be behavior guiding in a changing political landscape. That means that they need to be more precise. Maybe they need to give examples or case studies or something like that. Secondly, the rules need to be sensitive to content of speech. As it stands, rules solely depend on and are solely sensitive to the context, i.e., is something partisan? Well, is something partisan is going to depend on what's happening in the world, right? So we can definitely sort of drill down and give better guidance to our military leadership if we can at least in some circumstances say, hey, here are topics that regardless of the situation, it's okay to speak on, right? No matter, you know, how bad it becomes a partisan issue, here's a subset of things you may say nonetheless, or here's a subset of things you may never say regardless of context, right? So we're gonna still have to use context, but can we help ourselves to content to regulate such speech as well? And finally, these rules need to be sensitive to the relationship between the content and the aims. What do I mean by that? I just said that I think that good political neutrality rules shouldn't be based just on context, so the changing political landscape problem. Instead, we could sometimes pick issues that the military should be allowed to always speak on or never speak on. Well, how are we going to identify that? It can't just be sort of whatever we like, right? I think that we should pick the content of speech that is always permitted or never permitted based on how well that topic or issue, or taking a stand on that topic of issue, serves our aims in the first place. Remember our aims: building trusting civil and military relationships, true cohesion and morale, effective authority, and retaining trusted advisory role for national security policy. Now, if that's something that we are after, then I think one possible issue that our military leadership should take a stand on and can speak up on are so-called jus in bello rules. Namely, rules that you probably are more familiar with the term Geneva Conventions, right? So going back, there was a reason I gave you an example of carpet bombing and waterboarding, right? These are issues that, at least on the surface, seem to be in the military's lane, so to speak, seem to be the sort of a thing the military should take a stand on because it affects their function and their purpose. So one of the contents that I think the military can justifiably take a stand on are these jus in bello rules or Geneva Conventions. So let me tell you a little bit about the particular rules I have in mind. Rule number one is discrimination. Discrimination simply says that when you fight a war, you should discriminate or differentiate between civilians and combatants, right? You can, depending on your military objective, kill combatants. You may never target civilians. Proportionality says that in as much as you might unintentionally kill civilians, that needs to be proportionate to your aim. Necessity condition says that if you have two or three or four ways of achieving some military objective, And even if all of them meet the conditions of discrimination and proportionality, if some of them harm fewer people, you should pick the alternative that harms fewer people. And finally, we have POW treatment. POW treatment rules are very familiar. You can't interrogate in certain ways. You need to return prisoners of war back to their original state after the war ends. You cannot parade them, and so on and so forth, right? These are just a few of the cornerstones of just war rules. That's what Jus in Bello, justice in war, Jus in Bello stands for. And the sort of cornerstones of Geneva Conventions. They're the cornerstones of the rules, both moral and legal, that govern warfare, which is one of the primary functions, not the sole function, but one of the primary functions of our military. So with this in mind, consider statements by President Trump, and I gave you earlier the example by Ted Cruz as well, on issues of torture, that we should, on issues of nuclear weapons, that we could, and on issues of targeting terrorist families, that we will, right? All of these are explicit calls for violating the Geneva Conventions and violating the discrimination and violating the POW rules. So for example, statements on torture, there's a big difference between statements by President Trump on torture and statements by then President George W. Bush on torture. They did the same stuff. They waterboarded, they used all sorts of techniques, but President Bush tried really hard to call it enhanced interrogation techniques. President Trump calls them torture and says, nonetheless, we will do them. Use of nuclear weapons is also, and torture is of course a violation of our POW Geneva Conventions. Use of nuclear weapons is a indirect violation as well of the Geneva Conventions and of course a direct violation of prohibition on nuclear weapons. But the reason it's a direct violation of Geneva Conventions is because nuclear weapons are indiscriminatory, right? The cornerstone of international law and morality of war is that we discriminate. We make a difference between civilians and combatants. Nuclear weapons can't do that. They indiscriminately kill. And same is with targeting of terrorist families. By definition, they're civilians. So targeting them by definition violates the cornerstone of all international humanitarian law, namely the principle of discrimination. Because without principle of discrimination, you don't have principles of proportionality and necessity. You have to first differentiate civilians and combatants, and then all the other rules are about what you can do to one group and what you can do to the other group, or what you may not, right? So if you violate the principle of discrimination, you are, you know, the entire body of laws of war and the entire body of international humanitarian laws goes out the window. And notice that the principle that the limit that this principle imposes is very minimal. It simply says, don't target civilians, right? It doesn't even say you can't kill civilians. It simply says you can't target civilians, right? Proportionality says, and if you do accidentally kill them, this is how you can kill them. So it's an incredibly small principle. That's the bedrock of international law that our political leadership has consistently undermined. Now, that's a particular problem from international law. International law is different than domestic law. We all know that international law does not have as much teeth, so to speak, as domestic law. And the way international law governs is via norm projection. International law sort of governs by telling us these are the sort of things we strive for, these are the sort of things that are bad, and then we all the states in the world, sort of say, oh yes, we accept that, or we sort of criticize other countries when they diverge, right, from international laws. But international law's ability to govern depends almost entirely on widespread acceptance of norms, right, on customary norms. If we also suddenly start saying, actually, we are going to violate Geneva Conventions, international laws and Geneva Conventions don't have a robust set of tools to be able to govern still. These norms protect both our civilians, right, by suggesting that if there's ever sort of attack on our population, it should discriminate between our civilians and our combatants, but they also protect our troops. And one of the key reasons why most states uphold or even just pretend to uphold these basic laws is if they did not limit their actions in battlefield by being discriminatory in a good sort of sense, being discriminatory by not killing civilians and you know not treating prisoners of war poorly, then nor would their enemies. So these Jus in Bello rules are really important. They protect our soldiers. They protect the entire purview of what our military does very often. And they depend on, these international norms depend on us projecting their acceptance of them. So can you imagine that these sorts of statements by our military, by our political leadership, really undermine these norms? They genuinely undermine them and their ability to govern others' behavior. So this is one of the reasons I believe that this is the content, these are the topics that our military leaders can actually make an exception, content-based exception, to our political neutrality rules. They're well-placed, right? And they have epistemic authority to counter the expressive harm, right? If they come out and say, you know what, we actually don't kill civilians, right? If they publicly say that, we're against targeting families of terrorists, we're against torturing, then again, these other people in the world are gonna hear that and they're gonna know that our military is gonna fight according to at least those absolutely minimal rules. And that will give them reason to do the same, right? This gives us good reason to think that speaking out by military officers, especially upper level military officers, in favor of these invalid rules, in favor of Geneva Conventions, can stabilize them when our politicians basically destabilize them, right? But most importantly for my argument, right, speaking up in favor of jus in bello rules, in favor of international humanitarian laws, in favor of Geneva Conventions, can serve the same aims that the rules of political neutrality are meant to serve, right? So not only do I in fact think that military leadership can speak up on these issues, I actually believe that they ought to, that they're required, morally speaking, to speak up on these issues, right? And that is because I believe that political neutrality rules, the aims of political neutrality are best served by them speaking up. So remember, the aims of political neutrality were public trust, civil-military relationships, troop cohesion and morale, right? So if and when our military officers speak up in favor of Geneva Conventions and against and in response to political leadership undermining Geneva Conventions, they would serve public trust, one of the key aims, right? They would serve public trust because they would, these rules of discrimination protect our civilians. They're aimed to protect our civilians. We protect the civilians of people that we fight against, and they don't target our civilians, right? So knowing that our military is going to do the sorts of things that are required to assure that our enemies don't attack our civilians is important. That's one reason we trust them. It would help our uniform leadership. It would help to ensure that our troops are clear on what is expected of them regarding invalid rules. You can imagine that it would be really hard to govern a group of 100 soldiers or 300 soldiers or 1,000 soldiers. And you give them all these rules and you tell them you have to respect Geneva Conventions, and they have little cards with Geneva Conventions. But also suddenly they're hearing civilian and actually military leadership in case of president undermining these same rules they hold on the cards. So actually speaking up and clarifying that we do in fact respect Geneva Conventions would ensure that our troops know what is expected of them. And finally, it would help our troop morale. One of the essential things that keeps up our troop morale is their belief that they're fighting with honor, right? And also that, you know, assuring that they will be protected if they become prisoners of war. So that we give combatant privileges to our enemies and that in turn our enemies are going to take seriously combatant privileges, specifically POW status style privileges. The nut of my argument here is that if we think that political neutrality aims are so important, these aims right here, are so important that they can provide reasons to override rights to political participation and freedom of expression, right? So we say here are these really valuable political, here are these really valuable aims. And because of them, we're gonna tell our military leadership that they are certain times that they just can't speak. So we're gonna limit their right to political participation, limit their right to freedom of expression, basic freedoms, right? Because these aims are really important. Well, if these aims are so important that they can provide these reasons to override the rights to political participation, freedom of expression, then they certainly are important enough to ground an obligation to speak up in cases when the political establishment is undermining the international laws. So here's a little bit sort of a visualization of what I'm talking about. So if you think of the blue area as basically all speech, anything anyone can say, and then you think of, and this probably shouldn't be, this red area probably shouldn't be so nicely circumscribed, because as I said, it's not really clear how the rules can, so this probably should have been a little bit more sort of, rigged, or ridged, sorry. So, but if you think of, there's this subset of speech, subset of things and times our military leadership is not allowed to speak, right? And then you have a subset of topics, jus in bello types of speech, then I think actually that when those two overlap, when you have something that sounds partisan, and it is partisan because, you know, one party is saying one thing, let's say, let's carpet bomb, the other one's saying let's not, one party saying we can target civilians, the other one's saying we're not, it is a partisan issue. And you would think, therefore, the rules of political neutrality will tell me not to talk about it. But what I'm suggesting is, no, the rules of political neutrality serve certain aims, and those aims are sometimes better served by speaking up, specifically in cases of justice in war, jus in bello, in cases of speaking up in favor of Geneva Conventions. So here's some general lessons for political neutrality. Partisan and political are not sufficient to identify issues that one ought to not engage in publicly. They're just not clear enough. Because they're not clear enough, because the context keeps on shifting, political landscape keeps on shifting, so we need content as well, right? And one content exception could be, is this speech going to directly serve the same aims? And can I sort of sufficiently circumscribe it as a topic? I have, since writing this paper and since presenting this on numerous occasions to our military officers, specifically the Navy, I have extended, for example, another example, specifically questions of racial justice in broader society. I also argue that when it comes to certain basic issues of racial equity and racial justice in our society, that it is possible that at least topics, aims of troop morale and troop cohesion are better served by our military clearly taking a stand on issues of racial justice and racial equity. So the reason I'm mentioning this is the Geneva Conventions are just one example of a topic I think can be excluded from political neutrality. I think racial justice is another one. And I think there may be other ones as well. My test for which topics should we exclude is this one right here. So can this speech more directly serve the same aim? And is it sort of sufficiently circumscribed so I can say, well, it's just these sorts of issues, but not those sorts of issues. And so I also think there's some really interesting further topics for analysis with respect to systemic racism, which I've done since, gender diversity, as well as State Department policies. Thank you.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much. So now we will move on to a 15-minute Q&A portion of the program. So we'll have you submit any questions that you have via the chat function. You can access that by clicking on the chat box icon at the bottom of your Zoom screen. And while we wait for questions to come in, I would like to take a moment to mention that we have a great set of programs lined up for this fall semester, so keep tuning in to our website for the latest updates, and we always send out our email announcements about a week ahead of time. And then I would also like to remind everyone that we are still currently welcoming new members to ICFRC. So if you would like to become a member or renew a lapsed membership or just learn more about becoming a member, please visit our website at icfrc.org for some more information. So with that, we'll go on to the Q&A session, and I'm thinking how we'll do this is I will go ahead and read the questions out loud, and then up to you for answers. All right, so I see one already. So we have a question from Peter that asks, is the distinction between military and civilian clear-cut? And what about guerrilla fighters, partisans, freedom fighters, et cetera?
So it is not clear-cut by any means. So the distinction between combatants and civilians is very difficult to actually make sense of. However, these political neutrality rules are there are rules. Not every military has the same sorts of political neutrality rules. So these political neutrality rules only apply to our standing army and our professional army. And I don't think the issue of, you know, guerrilla fighters, for example, and terrorists are not going to particularly care about whether they're being politically neutral or not. So these rules are primarily limiting the political expression of our military standing army, and they're really unique to the U.S. military.
Okay, great. So another question from Bill, how should soldiers balance the need to obey the president with their norms about neutrality?
So keep in mind that my argument is primarily focused on what the military leadership should say. I think the military leadership, so I think first of all, regular soldiers should just obey their military leaders unless there's a direct violation of Geneva Conventions, and then there are clear avenues for disobeying orders. But I do think that when it comes to actions, our military leadership should obey our political and military leadership, namely the president. So the majority of this is about political expression. Now, I can imagine there might be some cases of political action, but by that I mean things like maybe going to a rally or something like that. It's not going to be things like disobeying an order because it's, you know, you don't like it or something like that. Now, keep in mind that, of course, in particular, given the topic I just discussed, you absolutely are required to disobey any orders that are patently against the Geneva Conventions. Now, what that looks like in practice and how hard it is for our military leadership and soldiers to figure out when that's the case, that's a separate issue. But that might be another reason, actually, to argue in favor of my view, which is that since we can disobey the president in action if he or she gives us a direction to, you know, kill a civilian, then we might as well speak up against it as well.
Absolutely. Okay, another question from one of our interns. Would the U.S. police use of tear gas on U.S. citizens during Black Lives Matter protests be an issue that military leaders ought to have a say in as well? And as the use of tear gas has arguably violated the Geneva Convention.
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly what I have most recently. So this is I've extended this sort of work now to include questions of racial justice. And I do think that our military leadership needs to take a stand on racial justice. I don't think that, so for me, content-based exceptions for what sorts of stuff the military should speak up on and our military leadership depends on how well do they serve the aims. And one of the aims is troop cohesion and troop morale as well. And so I do think it's incredibly important that our military stands up for racial justice and racial equity. And that strikes me as a no-brainer. And it seems very odd to me that, academics within military academies, Annapolis, West Point, Monterey, have, Colorado Springs, have stood up for racial justice. And so it doesn't seem to me at all controversial that our military leadership should, in the light of what's happening, say, we're against killing our Black citizens. Now, whether a particular, am I still there?
Yes, I can see.
Okay. Whether or not we should in particular speak up on particular tactics, I think that might be counterproductive. And, you know, while tear gas is a violation of Geneva Conventions only govern warfare, and we are not in war with ourselves yet. And hopefully we never will be, but, international Geneva Conventions fall under international humanitarian law, and international humanitarian law only governs human rights during war. So in fact, while tear gas is a violation of those laws, it doesn't apply in a domestic jurisdiction.
Okay, great. So I don't see any more questions yet, so I'm gonna add one of my own while we give people a few more minutes. I don't know if you look much at other countries in this respect, but how do you see the current U.S. military in terms of how well they are practicing political neutrality relative to other countries?
Ooh, that's a good question. It's harder. So, there's a sense in which, you know, imagine a difference between saying that somebody who's constantly sitting and watching TV is really brave, they never have an opportunity to be challenged, and somebody who sort of maybe is at times less than we want them to be brave, but they're like, whatever. They're out there running marathons and sometimes they get really tired, but they're not sitting at home. So it's a silly analogy, but it's the idea is simply put, they have less opportunities. We have become, and there are other countries as well, but we have become so partisan and so politicized that our military has a much harder time navigating how best to serve the troops and how best to continue having a civil military relationship. Now, I should point out, this is incredibly important that all the institutions in our country, every single political institution, the military is the one and only that has consistently over the last 20 years enjoyed significant trust by our general population, in spite of us having all sorts of thoughts about stuff that the military has done. Consistently over the last 20 years, as our trust in public institutions has poll after poll after poll dropped, in our Congress, in our health, you know, CDC, in whatever, our trust in our military has remained high, 70-80%. And so as in our courts has dropped, right? So as we enter a land of rule of law collapse or rule of law, significant shift to our rule of law, I think it's even more important than ever that we have one institution that we at least can still trust. And so I think the military needs to carefully balance. I don't think they need to take too many stances on political issues. But I do think that in certain cases like international law that governs war and killing people, and racial justice, for example, are two examples of times they need to speak up, I think.
Absolutely. So there are a few more questions. So we have one from Bill. Are you communicating your recommendations to the military? And I'll add, if so, how?
Right, I am actually. So I work really closely. My entire career, as you pointed out earlier, has been in military ethics. So I work really closely with people in a number of academies. So most recently, for example, I've given a talk in front of some 140, 150 O3 and O4 officers at the Navy Postgraduate College. And so they have since taken up all sorts of conversations about it. So I'm absolutely communicating with, you know, whoever will listen. But that's sort of the nature of the field. The nature of the field in military ethics is that, you know, you do careful philosophical work, hopefully, and then you try to communicate that to actual decision makers.
Absolutely. I know a few of our interns, both present and past, who are members of the military, have been very interested in your talk coming up and learning how, you know, as lower members of the military, how that applies to them. So that's really great. I'm glad you're sharing it with more.
So one of the things I think really that this is relevant for sort of people who are not officers is how it affects so-called moral injury. So regular soldiers, for example, if, you know, if they don't trust that we're not going to go do things that are completely against Geneva Conventions, that can cause what we in the field call moral injury. Mm-hmm. It's very much like psychological injury or PTSD or physical injury, but it's injury to their moral selves, how they see themselves as good or bad people, simply put, to oversimplify.
Great. Yeah, I can see how that would be very important. So I'll move to a question from John. He asks, is telling the truth and not lying essential or peripheral to unit cohesion and the like?
Ooh, that's a really tough one. I don't know. I think telling the truth is not, I mean, depends on what you are talking about. If you're talking about political speech, then I think telling the truth is key. And I think the uniform leadership needs to have like a clear joint view on certain topics. So the military should have a view. Shouldn't be individuals sort of out there. They can be the ones communicating the view, but they should have they should pick topics on which they do take a stand and then agree what that stand is and then communicate it to us, the civilians. But I'm not sure if John's question also means more general, you know, can we sort of lie to our soldiers to get them to do what we want? I mean, we do that in law as well all the time. I don't, you know, lying. Sometimes we have rules that, you know, don't seem like they make sense, but, you know, that's just, you know, given human psyche, we achieve better outcomes that way. So regarding whether, you know, an officer can lie to their subordinates to get them to do the right thing, maybe. But in terms of whether the military should lie either to its, you know, office, either to its soldiers about political issues or to the civilian population, no, in my view. Mm-hmm.
And another question that kind of goes along with this. So are there any studies on how acting ethically affects the mental health of military personnel?
Yes, there is incredibly sort of rich field that's called the field of moral injury. And it's become very sort of rich over the last 15, 20 years or 10, 15 years. And it studies exactly that. You know, moral injury used to be sort of mushed up with PTSD. It used to be mushed up with experiences of stress and trauma. But it's very significant and very different from wrongdoing and how wrongdoing affects our well-being and affects who we are. And it can have really significant, it can have incredibly significant effects on our well-being. I have a number of colleagues in, you know, I write papers with, you know, team leader of Navy SEAL Team One, and, you know, I've worked with people who have stood up to the military, who are in the military, who have since left the country and actually given up their American citizenship because of moral injury. And so I think it's an incredibly important issue. And I think it's been too long sort of confused with PTSD.
Wow, that's fascinating. So another question from Amna, who I believe you've had in a class and know. She's one of our beloved interns. She'd like to know, are domestic police officers also obligated to practice political neutrality? And in your opinion, should they, especially as they are becoming increasingly militant?
Probably. I mean, it seems, I haven't thought about this enough, to be honest, but I mean, it seems to me like the code of police ethics does in fact include some sort of not taking stances of certain issues, at least in the way they go about, exerting their duties or going about exercising their duties. But I don't necessarily think that police officers, you know, so they also, I think, need to be politically neutral to some extent when it comes to speaking in public. I'm not going to trust to call my police for, you know, my local police department to come help me if I feel somebody is robbing my house, if I'm afraid that if I'm wrong, they're going to shoot that person anyway, right? And so one of the reasons for me to think that they're going to shoot that person anyway is because maybe they came out and said disparaging things about, let's say, a minority group, or because, you know, so it's not just their actions that undermine, currently they undermine the general public's trust in our police force. I can also imagine just straight up coming out and saying disparaging things about minorities would obviously also undermine our ability to trust them. And that's just an example.
I think that's very relevant to the news today. It's very interesting. So one more question. So you've kind of already touched on this a bit, but since we do have some interns and some personal friends of ICFRC who are members of the lower ranking military, how do you suggest that if they are in a situation where they see a breach of morality and feel like they should speak out, how do you suggest that they do that safely?
Chain of command. I mean, so I have seen, you know, I've seen as in read and or heard personal anecdotes of many a story where the chain of command worked. Sometimes it does require numerous times, you know, pushing on the same issue, pushing on the same issue, pushing on the same issue. It does also mean sometimes going over, you know, higher and higher levels, but following the chain of command often does work. Not always, but often does work. The more difficult question is when it's something that, when it's an issue that you need to quickly respond to, when it's an issue you don't want to be waiting on, when you see or observe, like in cases of some of our soldiers, let's say you observe torture of prisoners of war, right? If sometimes following the chain of command might result in hundreds more people being tortured, or that particular person that's being tortured being killed or severely long-term disabled. And so in those sorts of cases, chain of command might not work, and you might need to, you know, go above and above and above and above. But I would, you know, my recommendation is not that the first sort of point of contact should be, let's call the media. That's never really the best way to proceed unless really nobody's listening and you think somebody's life is in danger.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. All right, so I think we'll wrap up the Q&A there. I think that was a really great discussion, though. So just to finish things off, we now conclude our program. I want to give a big thank you to Jovana Davidovich for the wonderful presentation. And again, I thank our sponsors and interns for your support and help pulling this together. And Jovana, I am honored to virtually present you with our coveted ICFRC coffee mug.
Oh, yay. Thank you.
We will be in touch with you on how to get it to you. So with
thank
that,
you for having
thank
me.
You. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for presenting to us. Thank you to our viewing audience for being with us. And with that, we're adjourned. So goodbye, everyone.
Bye.